Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail. This is the podcast where you control the conversation right here at the critically acclaimed network. My name is William Bibiani. I am a critic. Everybody calls me Bibs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic for the purposes of this particular podcast. You may address me as Rockmeister McCool. It was a cool nickname. I'm sorry, you can't see the quotes.
A cool nickname
That I came up with for myself.
Yeah, because you can do that.
Yeah, you can invent your own nicknames.
Like, if I wish I'd known that, I thought I let everyone else decide I was called Bibs. That was not my choice. I would have been like Nitro or...
Nobody else decided that that man should be called Sting, all right? He clearly came up with that name himself. I want you to call me Sting.
I just want to see that.
No, we're not going to call you... No, I'm Sting now.
I forget how the scene actually goes, but there's this great bit in Rocket Man, Elton John biopic, where Elton John is like, I forget what his original name was, and it's like, I decided to go by a different name. I want everyone to call me Elton. One of his band members says, that's my name. I'm like, yeah.
There's a rather amusing Scottish comedy film called Killing Bono, which is about somebody who knew Bono and staged this plot to kill him, but not really, as is just sort of this jilted band member. But there is a scene in that movie where Bono chooses his name. Also, my name is Bono now. And he puts on the shades for the first time. He's like, this is me, I'm Bono, and this is my look.
Yeah.
Like, what, that's just it? You're Bono now? Yep, I'm Bono. And he goes and sits up there on a bus, and he just sort of sits a couple seats up. I'm like, fine, you're Bono. And I'm the Edge, shut up!
We're not doing this for everyone. The Edge got in before the cutoff.
Okay, the Edge. I'm Nitro. Nope, no more.
That's it. You don't get to be Mr. Purple. The guy in another job's name is Mr. Purple. All right, we got to get going. This is We've Got Mail, the episode where we like to dedicate all our time to you. So going off the rails right off the bat was a bad move, and we feel bad about it.
A little bit of amusement for ourselves.
Anyway, this is our letters episode. You write in. The email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. And we try to read your emails. Read as many as we can. We can't always get to them all. But we answer questions. We talk about news of the day, if you're really fascinated by it, or theories, trends in movie history, favorite movies about so-and-so, whatever. We're kind of open. But again, we can't read every single letter. However, if you ask us to go back a really long time and read a letter that we missed, we may do it. And we're going to start off right now with a letter from B. Peterson.
B. Peterson contacted us on Twitter and said, hey, I wanted to write in something you said recently, but I actually wrote about this very topic like way back in May. So read that letter. So we are. We're going to read a letter from back in May of 2020, written by B. Peterson. The letter goes, Dear Cinnamon and the Fiendish Dr. Zoltan. Long story.
Yeah.
You've long suggested turning off Nymphomaniac Volume 2 10 seconds before the end. I'm not sure how we're supposed to know when that is.
Touche.
Surely you have like a time code now.
If you see a part right at the end of the movie before the credits that stinks, pretend you didn't see that. that's the only way that movie works.
Because apparently the last 10 seconds somehow ruined the whole thing. I haven't seen it. Volume 1 was plenty. I myself have edited a couple of films for experimental purposes. I edited the last scene of The Social Network, so that the lawyer is just telling Mark to settle, and it's not a redemption for him. That would have been a better ending, right?
If you don't remember what we're talking about, and this is something that I've found that some people have, like, completely forgotten how The Social Network ended. Mm. Because I did, like, list, like, the best movies of the decade or whatever, and I didn't put The Social Network on there. Mm. A lot of people are like, what about The Social Network? I'm like, because the last scene in the movie is Rashida Jones telling Mark Zuckerberg he's not an asshole.
The movie begins with somebody calling him an asshole.
And that's the scene that everyone points to as like this incredible bit of writing. And the point of the movie, the punctuation at the end of the film is that he's not. Yeah. And I'm like, but he is.
But he still is.
It's a terrible ending.
Look, David Fincher really needs to make The Social Network 2. Catch up with Mark Zuckerberg today.
He actually does. I would love to see that movie.
That's the movie that needs to be made
right
now.
I would love to see that movie.
Yeah. So the lawyer is just telling Mark to settle. And frankly, the whole movie sits better because of it.
Yeah.
The same effect occurred for me for Blue is the Warmest Color after simply lifting out all the graphic, extremely male-gazy sex scenes.
Yeah.
I tried editing all the problematic elements out of Once Upon a Time in Hollywood, but I gradually realized that all I was being left with was a whiny man whining. So I scrapped that project. NB, the last sentence Whitney just read was written in a letter. As these words, they do not represent his views or opinions. I'm not allowed to talk about Once Upon a Time in Hollywood because I work for Quentin Tarantino.
Yeah, this, you were just reading a letter out loud.
That
does not reflect your opinions in any way, shape, or form.
My I have no comment on those words on Once Upon a Time in Hollywood. All of this is to ask, aside from the legal aspects, what is our right to edit a finished film? If it results in a more successful or less problematic piece of art, could that edited piece replace the original? Or would it have to be a separate entity altogether? How far would one go with re-editing a picture until we're looking at a Ship of Theseus paradox? What historical precedents have been set regarding this matter? So many questions. Thank you. See you in the next one. B. Peterson. Well, thank you for writing that letter May.
That's a really, really good letter. That actually relates to a couple of things. We recently talked about Nymphomaniac in our recent episode of The Iron List, where we talked about the best movies ever made about the subject of sex. And we brought up that same topic once again, that we feel the ending doesn't work. For those who may be unfamiliar with the Ship of Theseus that was discussed at the end of that, it's an old sort of philosophical riddle where if you have a boat and you gradually replace every plank of wood in that boat piece by piece until, and gradually, not all at once. Until finally there is no original piece of that boat, but it still looks like the boat. Mm. Is that the same boat? Mm. There's not a great answer to that question. It's very, very much about like attitude and perception.
And we've discovered a biological parallel to that. Your cells regenerate in your body. You shed old cells, you grow new cells. And that happens every, I think the number is every 7 years or so.
Yeah.
You're now completely new cells.
Question.
Yeah.
In Time Cop, does Jean-Claude Van Damme go back more than 7 years? Does he go back more than 7 years? Because if he goes back more than 7 years, the whole ending with Ron Silver touching Ron Silver and exploding wouldn't happen.
Because they're different people, yeah.
They would, biologically, they'd be different people.
They don't, you know what? The movie Time Cop,
yes.
Curiously, didn't think of this.
Really? I thought they would have thought that shit out.
You'd think that Time Cop would be this steel trap of scientific theory, but as it turns out, no. Curious that. As for fan re-edits, as editing technology has become more ubiquitous and can be put in the hands of just any common consumer, people can re-edit films just on their laptops now at home just for fun, as B. Peterson is doing.
Mm-hmm. And it can be an editing project. It can be for a class or something. A lot of people make fake trailers for things as editing exercises.
Those projects often leak out onto the internet. One of my favorites was Shining. The feel-good family comedy, or like feel-good family dramedy of The Shining.
Yeah, they took all the funny bits, or like the bits where Jack Nicholson is like, smiling in The Shining.
Jack, and made Jack him... just can't finish his book. And then they added one line of dialogue where he's like Danny's new foster father, and raising this child made him a better person.
I think
they play Salisbury Hill by Peter Gabriel. It's amazing.
Yeah, it looks like it's a Cameron Crowe movie. Like, it's really, really great. That's a really, really fun one. Various bits of re-editing of other classics, often with no regard or little regard for original intent, has happened throughout cinema. People have been doing that for forever. What was that show Joe Dante did? That was like a big clip show. Where it was like this ever-evolving...
Oh, that's right. He did it. He did these live shows.
Yeah, and he would... Because he took all of these, like, trailers and tidbits and reels and created this whole thing.
There was this... When video technology first became available to consumers, like in the late 70s and early 80s, this became a huge kind of underground practice. Mm-hmm. And it was really kind of the start of what came to be known as culture jamming when I was a kid.
Oh, yeah.
Which was sort of... re-editing popular media in such a way where it almost seems like you're unlocking secret messages that are hidden inside. If you saw it all as a unit and remixed it a little bit, you would see an entire new message and a whole new narrative emerge out of all of these clips. It was a big part of the Church of the Subgenius. And videos would be released like that. You can still to this day find things like TV Carnage and Everything is Terrible. These people who try to find... really odd clips throughout all of popular media and re-editing them as these kind of art projects, essentially, these kind of meditations on what media is.
Mm.
I've always found those things are really exciting.
Interesting.
Yeah. It was being done in film, though. Steve Martin and Carl Reiner made a comedy called Dead Men Don't Wear Plaid.
That's a fun one.
Where they take clips from a lot of old noir films and edits the Steve Martin character into a drama, so it looks like he's starring opposite Humphrey Bogart.
Yeah, and Alan Ladd and all these other great movie stars. Mm. And it's a little spotty, and the thing with Carl Reiner is he's often really brilliant, but every once in a while he'll do something like really sexist or something for like one scene.
It was a different time.
I'm just saying, every once I recommend watching it because it's a fun editing exercise and homage to classic Hollywood, but you're going to run into a couple of scenes where you're just like, oh, that wasn't funny.
Yeah, it's just the humor doesn't play anymore.
Yeah, but mostly
And speaking of things that don't play anymore, Woody Allen did it. There's a film called What's Up, Tiger Lily, where
that's one where the original is like no one talks about it anymore.
Yeah,
it was he took a
Hong Kong action film.
It was a James Bond kind of knockoff, and he like re-edited it slightly,
dubbed a lot of his own dialogue, and
it was a curious experiment.
It's been going on for a while, but now out in the world, people can re-edit films all they want.
Yeah,
and it's unfortunately what we consider like a finished project is now just a legal matter.
Yeah.
Whether or not it works better. And I went to a screening hosted by one of the workers at Cinephile. He re-edited Inland Empire into a 90-minute film. It's like, Inland Empire is really, really good. I like it, but I feel like there's too much of it and it's not like really focused. So I just sort of trimmed it and kind of streamlined it in a way I like.
Yeah.
David Lynch would hate that.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely, he would hate that. And the studio wouldn't let you distribute that because they own it.
Exactly.
But if you're going to remix something, you can now.
Yeah, it can be done just as an art project in and unto itself. And sometimes you create something that is entirely new and different. One of the first, I think maybe the first silent movie I ever saw was Metropolis, but specifically the version by Giorgio Moroder.
Mm.
Giorgio Moroder is this really fun musician, did a lot of pop music in Europe, and then he produced some of the biggest soundtracks of all time. He produced a soundtrack to Top Gun, one of the great movie soundtracks. Say what you will about the movie, the soundtrack is a killer. And he wanted to re-release Metropolis with a score by like the hottest musicians of the day. And we're talking people like
Queen
and David Bowie and Pat Benatar and very, very now.
Mm-hmm.
What he discovered is that the movie was really not only incomplete, but just like a mess.
Mm.
And so he ended up not just adding a new soundtrack, but sort of trying to recreate. At the time, it was the most complete version of the film.
Mm.
But musically, and I think in the tinting that he added, it was so dramatically different from any other version anyone had ever seen in Metropolis that it was quite controversial.
Mm.
Like, okay, on one hand, this is cool. On the other hand, no, don't think this is what Fritz Lang intended.
Yeah,
so it's its own entity, and it's really fascinating, and it plays really good, but it's its own thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think the Moroder version of Metropolis might be one of the only like re-edits of a film that's also considered an official version.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people were considering it sacrilegious, but it was theatrically released as its own entity.
And we mean re-edits from people who didn't originally make it.
That's right. In not made, but like, you could talk about like how many edits of Blade Runner are there now? Like 15?
Yeah. But Ridley Scott's responsible for all but the first one.
Yeah. He's been tinkering and re-tinkering. Same with Friedkin and a lot of hit and The Exorcist. Like, he goes back and keeps trying to futz with it. You know, there's two ways of looking at it. You can sort of have the purist's look, which is, you know, you get one shot, edit the film you want, release it that way, and that's where it stands in posterity. And then there's the people who say, well, if it's your film, you can re-edit however you like, and that's what, you know, George Lucas does with Star Wars. That's what, you know, Friedkin and Ridley Scott do.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's the third, but it's never happened to my knowledge, other than Metropolis, where essentially a fan edit, a new edit of a film made years after the fact without any input from the original filmmakers.
Yeah.
Became the new standard version of that film.
Again, you remove things like studio pressure, where like they reshot the ending of Magnificent Ambersons away from Orson Welles.
Yeah.
That's its own thing. Censored versions of films. Sometimes the censored footage is gone forever. But yeah, no, the most interesting one I can think of, and it's still within the studio system, is the Peter Bogdanovich film At Long Last Love, which was lambasted when it came out.
And it's quite bad. I've seen it.
It's really not a good film. Yeah. But it's an attempt to recreate the sort of breezy musical charms of a Fred Astaire, Ginger Rogers movie, but using 1970s talent like Burt Reynolds and Madeline Kahn. And as a premise, it's not bad. As a movie, it kind of is. It's
lazy and interminable.
And it's been like re-edited a few different times. And for a long time, it was unavailable on home video. And then apparently Peter Bogdanovich saw that it was on Netflix and said, listen, it's been a long time. We're going to rewatch it. And he found out that he actually kind of liked it. And also that it wasn't his cut. And he didn't recognize the cut. The studio had done another one. And apparently he likes that cut.
All right.
He didn't know what the hell he was watching. So these things just keep happening. Yeah. Anyway. But that's a great question. Thank you for asking it. Mm-hmm. And let's move. Please check out B. Peterson's podcast network.
Oh, The Screen's Margins.
The Screen's Margins.
Is B. Peterson's podcast. And they're doing all kinds of awesome stuff over there.
Like, yeah, if you like our deep dives, you should check out Screens Margins. They're at Screens Margins on Twitter, patreon.com/screensmargins. Mark Edward Hoik from the Schmodown co-hosts some stuff over there. They're doing really cool work. So please check out their stuff. I highly recommend it.
Here's a letter from Will. Hi, Will.
Hi, Will.
Greetings, Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool. K-U-U-L-E. Every spelling is correct.
Always correct.
I just listened to your Iron List episode for the best movies about sex and wanted to share some of my picks that were not talked about.
Great.
I love these kinds of letters.
If you didn't listen to the episode, Whitney and I talked about the best films that we thought of were about sex, but we freely admit that sex is a hugely broad topic and there's bound to be stuff that we missed. So we want people to come in and chime in. So thank you so much.
So, and these are not numbered, just a list. Y tu mama también. Well, like now I consider Roma to be his masterpiece. Alfonso Cuarón's Y tu mama también is a magnificent movie, and its depictions of sexuality as well as the rifts it can place between individuals always captivates me. That is a good one. Y tu mama también. It's a really sweaty coming-of-age story. Carnal Knowledge. I've not seen Carnal Knowledge.
I haven't seen this in a long time.
While very, quote, controversial at the time, Mike Nichols' Carnal Knowledge has somewhat been lost to time, but I think it's terrific, featuring some beautifully restrained direction and some amazing performances.
Art Garfunkel is in that movie, if memory serves.
I believe he is.
Yeah, interesting.
He actually had a lot of film roles.
Yeah, he's just not talked about very often.
Because he's not a good actor.
Fair enough.
Shame from 2011.
I didn't see Shame.
I am a heterosexual male, but oh, Michael Fassbender, you tempt me. Otherwise, this movie is depressing as hell. Yeah, it is. It's really a wallow, that one. Short Bus.
This made your runners-up.
This is in my runners-up list. John Cameron Mitchell's Short Bus is one of the most experimental depictions of sex I've ever seen in cinema. Truly pushes the bounds of what sexuality in cinema can be without ever feeling exploitative. An underrated film. It's like all of John Cameron Mitchell's films. It's really... strangely emotionally earnest. It's very disarming. Even though it has explicit sex on camera, it's more about kind of the vulnerabilities of the characters than it is about, the actual prurient nature of what they're going through. And it is about the prurient stuff too, but how that is tied into our emotional well-being.
Sure.
Also, Under the Skin.
That's
an interesting choice.
In retrospect, I'm surprised you left that off. You really like that movie a lot.
I do. I like it a lot. I wouldn't call it a sex movie, though. So
I think it's about sex.
While not directly about sex, Scarlett Johansson's character actively wields sex as her weapon of choice, slowly unraveling the greater humanity within her glorious fashion. I love this movie and think it features some of the most bizarre and inventive, quote, sex scenes ever to grace the silver screen. Sex lies in videotape. Between this Crash and Secretary James Spader has some explaining to do.
he doesn't have to explain himself. He's cool.
He's in interesting movies. Yeah.
He's in interesting movies. Some of them are sexy.
And lastly, Don't Look Now. Once again, like Under the Skin, the film is not directly about sex, but the character very much uses sex as a method for coping with grief. In fact, Warren Beatty, who was dating Julie Christie at the time, vehemently demanded that her sex scenes with Donald Sutherland be cut, as they appeared too realistic.
Yeah.
If that doesn't indicate power of sex in this movie, I don't know what else does. Anyway, thank you for reading my letter. You are all my absolute favorite film critics.
Oh, thank you. Pish,
And remain a constant inspiration. Sincerely, Will.
That's an honor that you would say those things. Yeah, I haven't seen all those movies. The one that I have seen that I'm going, I don't know if it belongs, is Don't Look Now, which is this incredible horror movie from the 1970s, directed by Nicholas Roeg, starring Julie Christie and Donald Sutherland. Their young child dies at the end of the movie, and they grow estranged, and they go on a trip to Venice, but it turns out there's like ghosts, cultists, and maybe a serial killer in the canals, and how it all comes together, I will not ruin for you, but it's freaky. But there's this really well-known sex scene between Donald Sutherland and Julie Christie, which is very explicit, but it actually isn't very sexy. It's intercut with them like tidying up afterwards and putting on their clothes, and it's kind of about how they're still having sex, but they're not connecting.
It's
great storytelling. I don't know if it's really about the sex as much as that one scene is, though.
Well, and you said that one scene is pretty notorious, and it does inform the rest of the movie in a really interesting sort of way.
You can debate it. It's just the one where I'm going, maybe not. But other than that, it's a good list.
And Under the Skin, I've maintained that this was sort of Scarlett Johansson kind of coming to terms with her place in sort of the movie star firmament. And the way we tend to... It's sort of an examination of the male gaze, more or less, because it is about a woman who looks like Scarlett Johansson seducing men off of the street.
But then instead of taking them to have sex, she takes them to an infinite void.
Yeah, she like plunks them down in this liquid black void, and that's like sort of the sex scenes in that movie.
Yeah, it's a fascinating film.
Yeah, it's really, really good. I loved Under the Skin.
It's not my favorite, but man, is it interesting and is it worth seeing. Like, it's really, really cool.
Brian Grazer did that one. Brian Grazer,
Is it Brian Grazer? Jonathan?
Jonathan Grazer. Brian Grazer is the producer.
Yeah.
It's a really good movie, though, and Jonathan Grazer has only done that. He did Birth as well, which is another really fascinating movie, which he did more frequently.
Glazer.
That's what I said.
You said Grazer.
Glazer, sorry. Jonathan Glazer.
To be clear, Jonathan Glazer.
Jonathan Glazer made Under the Skin.
Yes, just...
Brian Grazer produces Ron Howard movies.
Nobody's perfect. We're going to leave it in the show.
Here's a letter from Fab. Hi, Fab.
Hi, Fab.
Hello, Bibbs and Rockmeister McCool. To the person who wrote in about the scene of a man having his hand nailed to a chair with a nail gun.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, somebody wrote in last week asking... We sort of outsourced this to our listeners to see if we could figure out a mystery scene from a listener's head.
Just to recap, a lot of people, like, especially the older you get, the more of these you have, this one thing from a movie you remember, but you haven't seen it in 30 years, and so you're a little hazy on what the hell it was, and it's a little difficult to describe, and then maybe one day you find out what it was, and you go, that's it! That's the connection!
I remember seeing this.
And that was used to be the purview of the video store clerk. That was like the coolest thing you got to do as a video store clerk, was get to solve these little riddles. Now we're doing it on the podcast. So we will outsource these if we can't recognize them. Yeah. And so there was a scene with a nail gun. Let's talk about it.
Well, Fab says, I'm thinking the movie is Color of Night. The steamy 90s thriller with Bruce Willis. Nails through hands was also a mystery scene from my own childhood memory, but I saw Color of Night recently for a podcast, How Did This Get Made? And my mystery was solved. It's steamy, kind of cringy, so bad it's good, batshit crazy, worth a watch. Sincerely, Fab.
It is a very, very strange film. Isn't it from Richard Rush, the guy who did The Stuntman?
I believe it was.
Which is weird, because The Stuntman is an amazing motion picture.
Yeah, I saw it for the first time recently for this podcast.
And Color of Night is not good. Interesting, I guess, but not good. So that might be it. Let us know to the people who wrote in. Let us know if that's what you were thinking of. I believe we also had several of the people. They said there was another movie they were trying to remember about a person with completely pale skin screaming in fear. And a lot of people theorized that it might be the film Powder, which is plausible. So let us know if that's it. If not, we will keep looking.
Powder. I liked it until I learned about the director.
Yeah, let's not speak of that.
Yeah. Here's a letter from Melissa. Hello, Melissa.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Bibbs and Whitney. I really enjoyed listening to your latest mail episode, and you talked about how there should be major awards for stunts in films. There are the Taurus World Stunt Awards, which aired on TV, I think Fox, in the early 2000s. Hmm. I had seen some of it, and it's exactly like what you said, watching clip reels of unheralded stunt performers, doing dangerous stuff like high falls or being set on fire. One award went to a driver for doing a car stunt in The Fast and the Furious, where she doubled for Michelle Rodriguez and weaved her car in and out from under a truck during a chase scene. Another part had performers in protective gel do a runway walk while on fire.
Wow.
It was featured in the documentary Double Dare. I've seen that documentary, which about the stunt women, Jeannie Epper and Zoe Bell. It was also really cool to see those performers recognized for their risky and dangerous work. All the best, Melissa.
Thank you for reminding us about that. I'd forgotten that was... And there are awards for just about everything in the movie industry. Yeah. A lot of them don't get the attention that the Academy Awards do. So it's cool that they aired that. I actually forgot that they aired that. Mm. It sounds like an awesome show.
Yeah, I don't remember any of this. It does sound like something that would have aired on Fox in like the late Spike. 90s or something. Yeah.
Spike TV would have been all over that.
And I'm sure it would have been very, you know, chest hair testosterone. It's like, drink your Monster energy drink and set somebody on fire.
I remember I was watching when I first moved into an apartment out of college, and I had roommates and we were just finding our way in the world, and we had basic cable. Ooh, what a treat. And we had Spike TV. And one night on Spike TV at like 11 o'clock, they had a televised paper, rock, scissors tournament.
Oh my God.
It was like the movie Over the Top, but with like, it was like less badass. Like it was awful. No, it was actually weirdly captivating. And I lost like $10 on the final game.
You know what? I have never had cable in my life. I didn't grow up with it. So I talked to other kids. It's like, oh, yeah, do you remember growing up watching Nickelodeon? Nope, that was cable TV. I watched network TV and UHF stations.
Yeah.
I was completely detached from the cable world. And as such, I also missed out on things like The Sopranos and Six Feet Under and all the premium stuff.
You missed nothing.
So, yeah, I still haven't seen a single frame of The Sopranos.
It's not an important show.
No. I don't care.
Yeah.
But even though I missed out on maybe some cultural touchstones, I'm a little proud that I did not ever fall into the pit of reality shows that were on on just littering the TV landscape in like the late 90s and early 2000s. Just that was never an option for me, and I never went that way. I never found out what it was all about. I never saw Spike, and I think I'm better for it.
Yeah, you saw the best of Spike. You saw Blade the series when I canceled.
That's right. I saw one Spike series. I saw Blade.
And actually, you know what? Wasn't bad.
Wasn't bad. Sticky Fingers is a good Blade.
Actually, he was a good Blade. I'm gonna throw that out there. Just remind everybody, there was already been another Blade, Sticky Fingers, and he was fine.
He was just fine.
Yeah. All right. Let's move on.
I'd have to look it up, but I remember the his co-star, the female lead of that show.
Oh yeah, what was her name?
Was really really good in that show.
Let's give credit where credit is due. Hold on. I looked up Spike instead of Blade. Blade.
Spike Blade. Oh no! I just looked up Puppet Master.
Jill Wagner.
Jill Wagner is really really good in the Blade TV series.
She absolutely is. Mm. And where could we find her? Mm. She's doing the Mystery 101 TV movies for Hallmark. Which is a pretty good letter gig if you can get it. She was also in such Hallmark films as Christmas Cookies, A Harvest Wedding.
You've seen Christmas Cookies.
I have seen Christmas Cookies. I think I've seen Christmas Cookies. Christmas in Evergreen, Letters to Santa. Christmas in Evergreen, Tidings of Joy. Hearts of Winter, which is a little bit more general.
Christmas of Evergreen.
Yeah, she was also did a lot of Teen Wolf.
The Riddle of the Traveling Skull. which is actually the title of a Harry Stephen Keeler novel. Look up Harry Stephen Keeler. You'll like him.
Moving on.
Here's a letter from Tom with an exclamation point.
Tom!
Hello, Tom. Hello, both. Hello.
Hi.
First of all, I must thank you for the hours, and I really mean hours of entertainment you provide for myself and all of your fans/listeners around the world. You're welcome.
Thank you. Someone pointed out online that we did like 10 hours of shows last week alone.
Yeah.
And I was like, I was literally depressed before I read that tweet that we weren't doing enough.
We were not putting out enough content.
I still don't feel like we are.
Oh, sorry, I said the C word.
We'll erase it from the lexicon eventually.
Yeah. Your podcasts have been so valuable to me during my lockdown, so thank you for the entertainment and the hundreds of movie/TV recommendations you have provided across your catalog of podcasts.
That's
the least we can hope for. Now my question. I love your podcast, Only the Best. It's my favorite podcast of yours. And I'm a huge sucker for the Oscars and awards shows in general. My question is, have you ever considered doing a bracket-style knockout tournament with all of the Best Picture winners to determine the ultimate Best Picture winner? Speaking of Spike TV, I think this could provide a really nice recap after you made your way through every year of Oscar nominees, as well as a fun exercise to see the both of you debate which movie deserves to advance to be in the next stages and so on. Movies could be seeded based on their IMDb score. Not ideal, but every older movie has a Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic. Not every movie has a Rotten Tomatoes or Metacritic score. I would happily create the brackets if you want it. Again, I love hearing you both debate and defend your movies, and I love your list-based content. This was just an idea I had, and I was wondering if you'd ever do podcasts of this nature. I know you have 1,000 other podcasts on the go, too, so I totally understand if you feel as if this may take up too much time. Thank you both again from the bottom of my heart. All the best, Tom.
Tom, thank you so much for writing in. If you're unfamiliar with what he's talking about, over at our Patreon page, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork, we have a podcast called Only the Best, where Whitney and I are in the process of reviewing every single film ever nominated for Best Picture, and it's a pretty time-consuming process, and sometimes I wish we had fewer podcasts just so we could get through that one quicker, because I love that show. In any case, yeah, that's been quite a journey. We're still in the 19... We actually just started the 1940s. But the question is, would we be interested in doing, like, a bracket-style podcast challenge? I'm going to go out on a limb here and say that that's not Whitney's bag.
I mean, I'd do it if you really want, but no, those sorts of debates don't interest me so much.
We had a really good time on the Screen Drafts podcast last summer when we did sort of a competitive top seven list, I think, of the best When Animals Attack movies.
That's right. Yeah, we did.
That was fun.
That was pretty fun.
I would love to go back on Screen Drafts again. If you know the people at Screen Drafts, please tell them to call me. I loved that show. That was a real fun show to be a part of.
We'll come back. We'll do it.
Yeah. Just tell us, please. Something like that'd be fun, but I don't know.
The problem is we are critics, and the idea of, like, pitting films against one another, while fun, isn't really criticism. It's just sort of a game.
But it is kind of built into the Oscars.
That's true. Let's choose what the best film is. Something I've always wanted along this line is a Rotten Tomatoes master score.
Like,
what is, take everything that's been reviewed on Rotten Tomatoes, every single film, thousands and thousands of films and TV titles, and average out the Rotten Tomatoes score.
What's the average Rotten Tomatoes score for all of art?
All of entertainment right now, where does it stand? What is the master score? Is entertainment fresh? Or is it rotten now?
Okay, I love that idea.
Yeah. It's like, what's the running score right now? Well, we're for 54%. A lot of it sucks, doesn't it? We need to work harder on that.
That's hilarious. I really do like that idea.
And when our colleague Matt Atchity was running Rotten Tomatoes, he's not doing it anymore. I suggested that to him, and he said, no, we're never doing that. That's a terrible idea. It's like, no, it's great. I want the one big, like, is it a big tomato right in the middle, or is it?
Well, if it's not a five, if it's not, like, because again, obviously it's fresh or not fresh. That's the whole Rotten Tomatoes way. But there's a percentage score, and I think if the percentage isn't at least somewhere around 50, then that's not average anymore.
No, the way Rotten Tomatoes works is, if it's a 6 out of 10, they consider that fresh.
Yeah, anything over 60% is a technically fresh movie. 59% or lower, you get a Rotten Tomato. Yeah,
and that's Rotten Tomatoes' own dictate. That's something they came up with.
They decide what that is.
And again, to recap really quickly, the critics get to choose whether or not their own reviews are rotten or fresh they submit it to Rotten Tomatoes.
Sometimes the editors do that for the critics, but it is supposed to be decided by the people submitting the thing. So. Yeah. But it does raise the fun question, though. And I'm curious, have you seen every film ever won Best Picture? Or there's no, still blank spots? Okay, there's still some blank spots. Fair enough.
I think the biggest one might be From Here to Eternity. I haven't seen that
film. I never saw From Here to Eternity. No shit. Okay, well, out of curiosity, off the top of your head, if you had to pick like the two or three best Picture winners.
Of the winners.
Only the winners. And I know this is a big ask. This is off the top of your head. What are like the first three that come to your mind?
Oh, golly, that's a tough one. Yeah, I don't know.
Okay.
That is kind of a tough ask.
Yeah, that's a lot. That's a lot to process.
I know. Ben-Hur.
Okay.
Cuckoo's Nest.
One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest.
That's right. Try to like, come into it a little bit sideways. Not just any of the more expected ones.
Yeah.
You
can do it, man. I believe in you.
Moonlight.
Okay.
Those three.
That's a good one. I would go All Quiet on the Western Front.
Okay.
I was thinking about that while you were thinking. All Quiet on the Western Front. It's not easy. I'll say Rocky. I think it is the, much like Ben-Hur, it's the quintessential like Oscar-y kind of movie.
Yeah.
But it's really fucking good. Like, I love Rocky to pieces. So I'll say Rocky, and fuck it, I'll also say Moonlight.
Okay.
Damn good movie, honestly. So anyway, but yeah, fun thing to think about. And who knows? Maybe we'll change our tune when the time comes, when we actually catch up. It'll be a while.
I think an interesting way to do brackets would be like one podcast per debate.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know how we could come up with the actual brackets, because sometimes a film that's not very good will win round after round after round, whereas something much better would be eliminated early just because it was like up against something much better.
Here's what we do, just to simplify it. First and last. Hmm. So like the first wave, it's Wings versus Parasite.
Oh, there you go.
If we did
kind
it
of,
now.
Kind of work it in.
Yeah.
Meet in the middle.
And that would be an interesting conversation, because those films actually don't have a lot to do with each other. They both deal with class, kind of, but like Parasite's
one's a war story, it's the sort of like pulpy class metaphor.
That's pretty apples to oranges, actually, and it'd be an interesting conversation, because Wings is fucking awesome.
Mm-hmm.
Like, no disrespect to Parasite, which is also fucking awesome and one of the best picks they've had for Best Picture in a while, Moonlight notwithstanding. Like, those are like the two most interesting ones, I think, in the last decade. Wings is a fucking killer. Wings is a great fucking movie. So that, I'm not actually 100% sure what I'd choose there offhand. Mm-hmm. So yeah. Anyway, that's a fun thing to think about. Let's do one or two more.
Okay. Here's a letter from, it's just signed off as FNI. Hello, FNI.
Hi.
Hey, Bibs and Mestrepeda McFrio, excuse me.
Okay.
Mestrepeda McFrio, which is Rockmeister McCool in Portuguese.
Nice.
I'm Fabio, who goes by Vidan Alata. I'm going to massacre this. Vidan Alata on Twitter.
Okay.
Writing from Brazil.
Hello.
Hello from Brazil. I could go on and on about our own dumb fascistic president, but that's not what I want to talk about. But it is part of it, since you guys are in a are a great part of my attempt to not get flooded with all the bullshit. I started to follow your podcasts with critically acclaimed number 13, when you talk about the Orca movie, and ever since you've been a part of my life.
I plan
to write a list of Brazilian movies that you should try to get to, since Bibbs once commented that he wanted to know more about it.
That's very true.
And we here had a period during our military dictatorship where the only movies that were made were softcore porn, basically. And then in the 90s and 2000s, we had a period called retomada, or resuming. And that is the time period you should go to if you wanted to start with our cinema.
Great.
There were a few things that I wanted to talk about that escaped me now, but since I wrote this, I could keep going another time. Just to say, I'm a great fan of yours, and you helped me a great deal. Just be safe, guys. FNI.
And you be safe, too. And I would love, please, I would actually really, really love to learn more about Brazilian cinema. Not a lot of it gets over in America, or at the very least, not a lot of it does with any fanfare or like notoriety. I'm sure that, you know, if we looked hard at various streaming services, we could find some, but it's not necessarily very well curated, and it's hard to, there's not a lot of discourse about it to like look into and say what is considered great Brazilian cinema, what is not, you know. And that's true for a lot of different countries all around the world. Yeah, I'm sure wherever you are, I'm sure you can think of at least a couple of countries where you know next to nothing about their movies, and they probably make a lot of them.
Yeah, yeah.
So I've been trying to be more, a little bit more aggressive in experiencing international cinema, but I've got so much catching up to do.
Yeah,
like, I would love to become an expert in the cinema of every single country, and I just it's a lot.
From what I understand, there's a really great film playing right now. You can get it at like Lemley's Virtual Cinemas from Cote d'Ivoire. Mm. I don't think I've seen any films from Cote d'Ivoire, so that would be a first for me.
Yeah, that's cool.
Yeah, just I want to see one fun film from at least every country.
There you go. That'd be great. Yeah. So so please write it. We would love to read that list. Please write in with that list. Put like a star on it or something, so when they can find it, we can read it in another episode or two, or however long it takes. You know, no rush.
A couple more. One more.
Yeah, that was pretty brief. Actually, we had time for a few more.
Here's a letter from Cecil.
Okay.
Hi Cecil. Hi Bibbs and Rocky. Hello. I've seen a lot of movies because of you guys. My favorite is The Silence of the Hams. Yay!
That makes me happy.
The Silence of the Hams is so good.
I still haven't even seen it, and I know how much Whitney loves it.
You want to borrow my VHS? I have one.
Yes.
The Silence of the Hams is this really ambitious slapstick comedy spoof movie. It sounds really stupid because it's called The Silence of the Hams.
It's a spoof movie. Of course it's really stupid.
It's a spoof movie.
One of my favorite spoof movies is called Jane Austen's Mafia. That's a stupid title. It's supposed to be. That's the joke.
Jane Austen's Mafia is also pretty good.
Yeah.
It was made by an Italian filmmaker named Ezio Greggio, who was plucked from Italy's comedy world personally by Mel Brooks. He was actually looking for a protege and found this guy, Ezio Greggio, and he made The Silence of the Lambs and The Silence of the Hams. And
because ham is funny.
It's one of those like four gags a second kind of movies, and some of them don't land, but most of them do. It's completely stupid. And I love it.
Cool.
The Hannibal Lecter character is played by Dom DeLuise.
Of course he is.
The Jodie Foster character is played by Billy Zane.
Okay.
There's cameos from like Larry Storch and Larry Storch and John Astin.
You're able to get Larry Storch in your movie.
There's a completely bizarre cameo right at the beginning with Joe Dante and John Carpenter.
What? That I didn't know about. That's funny.
The scene goes, Joe Dante is on his back on a street, clutching his chest, having just been shot. We don't see it happen. Okay. He's just dying on a sidewalk. And he says, and John Carpenter's grabbing his lapels, "Tell me who did this, man."
Okay.
They set up a gag and it pays off. I don't want to say what the gag is.
Oh my God, that's... But yeah, wow.
Joe Dante and John Carpenter have a scene together in this movie.
Okay, that went from one of these days I'm going to get to because Whitney likes that movie to I am definitely getting to that movie. That movie sounds amazing.
I think you'll hate it. But anyway.
Oh, really? I love stupid movies.
All right, maybe you'll love it.
I love Brain Donors as much as you do. I love Freaked as much as you do. I love Loaded Weapon more than you do.
It just makes me guffaw. I have also watched a lot of strange movies because of you guys. The Love Witch.
Oh, there you go.
The Watermelon Woman.
Yay.
Would You Kill a Child? And
Who
Could Kill a Child?
I think that's the official title, but yes.
And Perfume, to name a few. Have you seen Perfume?
No, that one's all you, baby.
It's a Tom Tykwer film. Yeah, that's a really good movie.
Yeah.
Serial killer movie about a mad perfumist.
Sounds like a Batman villain.
Yeah, I think it's important for me to find movies people talk about as classics as well as obscure ones. This is true.
Yeah.
My favorite thing to do is to recommend a movie to someone that I think they'll love, but they have never heard of before. Double that if I own it and can just give it to them.
That's why I have this DVD collection. That's mostly that.
That said, watch This Is Not a Film. Cheers, Cecil. Just a recommendation. I think it's an Iranian film, This Is Not a Film.
I believe so, yeah.
And it was made by somebody who was in lockdown. Yeah. And they had to call it that so they could sneak it out of the country.
Lockdown is, I think, a lot of people think of that.
Not,
it's like, this isn't like COVID.
Not COVID,
like,
he was under house arrest.
He was under house arrest for being like political, and he wasn't allowed to make movies. And so he made movies on the sly on his phone and had to like sneak it out of the country on like a flash drive. And it's a pretty fucking amazing story. All right, let's move on.
Okay, here's a letter from Hayden. Hello, Hayden.
Hi.
Hello. The other day, I and a friend of mine were discussing the film The Brown Bunny.
Oh,
and the career of Vincent Gallo, which for those uninformed, basically died after the release of the film just mentioned. On sites like Letterboxd, there's a good amount of people who ascribe that narrative to Roger Ebert ruining Vincent Gallo's career after he deemed The Brown Bunny, quote, the worst thing to have ever premiered at the Cannes Film Festival. And if you were around in like 2003, it was this huge back and forth between Ebert and Vincent Gallo.
It's an extremely common thing in my experience over my lifetime for movies to be either like, oh, they had a 20-minute standing ovation. And I'm like, really? Because I would get tired and sit down. And also people would be like, yes, people were booing. Everyone left the theater. Like the crowd at Cannes is really... really not shy of telling you how they feel about your movie, whether they love it or hate it. And there's a lot of movies, sometimes really, really good movies, that get like the worst reputation at Cannes. Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas got booed at Cannes. I remember Personal Shopper got a big standing ovation at Cannes, and at another screening, it got booed at Cannes.
So, I like Personal Shopper's very good.
Very, very good.
I'm a big, big fan of Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas. Whether or not it's a good film is a matter of some debate.
Fair enough.
It's kind of unwatchable in a lot of ways.
Let's finish the email anyway.
It's kind of a long letter. So, my friend does think that there is some truth to this statement. While I think it's 95% bullshit for the following reasons: one, Vincent Gallo is a humongous Trump-loving racist, sexist, homophobic asshole who is super competitive with Ebert and even put a death curse on him.
Yeah, I heard about that.
Two, in general, the film wasn't that well received. Wasn't that well received beyond Ebert. Yet you could argue that Ebert set the table for a film's reception, as he at the time was the most famous critic on the planet. But Ebert was a famous detractor of Blue Velvet and A Taste of Cherry. Both respective filmmakers went on to have acclaimed careers.
Yep.
You might not know it, but Rob Reiner kept on making movies after Ebert wrote, "I hated this movie, hated this movie," about his film North. And on top of all of it, Ebert gave a positive review after Gallo's film after seeing it re-edited post-Cannes. He gave it a 3-star review.
Yeah.
After it was cut down a little bit.
Yeah, because it was a different version of the film. Mm-hmm. You have to do that if the movie changes dramatically.
Yeah,
you know?
And like, it was dramatic enough that now this makes sense.
Yeah.
Have you seen The Brown Bunny?
I didn't see the Cannes cut. I saw the cut that got theatrical.
Yeah, as did I. There's a scene in the theatrical release where Vincent Gallo, he's drifting across America and he's stopping and talking to people. And,
yeah. Every single woman he meets has a flower name and it all relates to baggage.
And they all fall in love with him and are they in his mind? He's clearly lost in his own head. And
yeah, plays like a really long student film.
Which it is. And there's a scene where he stops and he gets on a motorcycle.
Yeah.
And he on the like the big salt flats out in the middle of the desert, and there's this one static shot where the camera's kind of locked down and he gets on his motorcycle and he just drives into the distance.
Away
from the camera, and it just stays on him and he just vanishes. And then it cuts to the next scene. He's back in the car and he's driving away. In the original cut, and I remember this from Ebert writing about that shot, he drives off and he vanishes into over the horizon. He's just gone. And then there's a pause. And then we see the shot continues. We see him drive all the way back. It's like, okay, well, the whole point of his, he's just disappearing into the landscape. Poignant image.
Yeah.
Disappearing and coming back out of the landscape and getting back in his car and driving away is just watching a guy riding a motorcycle. Well, there's no meaning to it anymore.
It goes from having like something relevant to it goes from being relevant to the rest of the story to being a literal exercise in futility. It plays like a joke.
Yeah.
If you do it that way. Is there more to the email?
Yeah, there is.
Okay, let's finish it up. Yeah.
Plenty of things that have been critically reviled go on to be successful with audiences. Home Alone is now treated as a holiday classic, and it wasn't getting 4 stars left and right.
Nope.
You can be an asshole in Hollywood, but not an unpopular one, which Gallo is. His public feud with Ebert really didn't help his career. In 2 years before, he called his underage star some really nasty things. I don't want to repeat them. And basically a puppet. He does he even deserve a career in the first place? Also, the guy moved into Trump Tower. I didn't know that.
I didn't hear about that.
Oh, God.
I don't know if that's true. That's
I think
crazy.
He's doing just fine. However, for the sake of argument, let's ignore the five-minute scene at the end of the movie and ask a question. Can a critic ruin a career?
Yeah.
Not really, but at least not 99% of the time. A critic reception can tarnish a film, but it's hard to find an instance where one critic ruined a film or director's chance at success. Signed, Hayden.
Okay. So real, real fast, Brown Bunny. It's exactly as we described it. Mm. Again, the actual movie itself, I don't think it's very good. I just don't. And I didn't see the Cannes cut. If it's worse than what I saw, I think that sounds like a pretty bad movie. And I don't blame Ebert one bit for doing his job and saying he thought the movie stank. That's the gig.
Yeah.
It's not like it's playing at like some tiny little festival. If it's playing at Cannes, it's already got its foot in the door. It's perfectly fair to say if it sucks or not. Regarding the question of, and I don't know enough about, I've heard things about Vincent Gallo. He doesn't seem like a cool guy, but I don't know anything about him.
Well,
really,
he's always been a bit of a weirdo. You can go to his, you can go to his website and rent him for sex for a night. Like, he's selling his body on his own website.
Right. Which, again, I'm not going to, like, decry sex work, but at the same time, I don't know what's up with that. I don't know what he's doing.
He's doing it because he has such strong genetic stock. He's essentially studying himself out.
Yeah.
Like he's like a racehorse or something.
Yeah. So I'm not going to speak to any of that. Regarding whether or not a critic can ruin a movie, nope. Not today. And that's a big difference. There was a time when critics held a lot more sway than they do now. Not necessarily explicitly in film. There's actually, people forget, because people talk about film criticism all the time. There's a lot of other kinds of art criticism. There's music criticism, there's theater criticism, there's food criticism. There are worlds in which a bad review from an esteemed food critic can ruin a restaurant.
Right.
And there have been periods of time in which the critical community in the theater scene was so powerful that they could shut down a play if the review was bad enough.
Watch the movie All About Eve for dramatization of that.
All About Eve is a good example of that. This was the world of the Algonquin Roundtable. Look that up. It's a fascinating group of people. Basically, the wittiest people in New York City got together at a hotel called the Algonquin, had a big round table for them all to sit at, and they were these local celebrities. And they would say dry, ribald, or mean things to each other, and then they would go off and they would write poetry or books or humorous essays, and a lot of them were also theater critics, and they could destroy a play in a night if Dorothy Parker hated your play. That was an actual reality. Nowadays, it's not really a thing, and I think because the art that we're talking about, particularly film, is so easily accessible now, than at least compared to what it used to be, people don't have to take a critic's word for it. It's so much easier to just check it out for yourself. And as a result, I think the idea of critics trying to protect the masses from what they considered bad art, which is, of course, gatekeeping, but regardless,
we're critics, that's what we do. It's kind of our profession.
There's a really bad way to do it, obviously. But I think that mentality has mostly died. And I think it's easy for some people to say, no, critics didn't like, I don't know, Batman v Superman, and that's why it didn't make $1 billion. And I'm like, no, because if that were the case, then all the Transformers movies wouldn't have made that money.
Yeah,
because
those things were panned.
It's not a critic's responsibility to represent the opinions of the masses. That's not the job.
No.
It's not like, oh, I'm supposed to come here and say what most people think. No. You're supposed to say something interesting and insightful, and hopefully entertaining if you can manage it, and get a conversation going that is can be very critical, but it's also fair. That's what the job of a critic is. And sometimes people do not see something because a critic that they trust didn't care for it.
Yeah.
More often than not, they're likely to see something if a critic that they trust cared for it. And if they have any interest in seeing something, typically, even if a critic doesn't like it, they're still likely to see it because it's not that hard to do so.
Well, another big blow to, I'm not going to say critics' credibility, but critics' control of film conversation came with the internet. When people could self-publish their own film reviews, you no longer had to be sort of a vaunted expert or a professional writer to be published. You could just publish your own opinions, and now and anybody could write about film, and film writing in general, and sort of the tenor and the timbre of the conversation became a lot broader. Film writing as a hobby just became this huge activity. Anybody can just start their own blog about whatever movies they're watching. That, unfortunately, sorry, knocking things over. that unfortunately took away a lot of film writing as a profession. So we got in at just the wrong time.
Yeah, it's hard to make a living at it because there's so much of it out there. Yeah. On the upside, there's a lot more out there. Mm. And I think that's better for the art form of criticism to have more voices easily accessible. The fact that it was easier to make a living at being a film critic, for example, was an unfortunate side effect of there only being so many jobs to go around.
Yeah.
There was only so much of a market for it because everyone only read one or two newspapers. So that was a different environment. But as a result, a lot of people got shut out of that conversation because there wasn't enough material to go around. Now, a lot more people can have their voices heard. And I think the discussion around film, I don't always agree with every avenue it takes, but I think in some respects it's never been better. At least it's about contemporary cinema. I think there's always a blind spot for older stuff. Mm. But I think for contemporary cinema, I think we're actually in a really exciting place and it's getting better for the most part. But unfortunately, it's so readily available that fewer outlets are willing to pay for it. Yeah. And that sucks because people are producing wonderful works of criticism. Insightful. Interesting. Getting people excited about aspects of the medium that they never thought about before, recontextualizing new films and old films in ways that expand our awareness, not just of that film, not just of cinema, but of the world around us. Holy crap, that's fantastic. And I'm just going to say it, it's worth money. The time and effort, a lot of people do it as a hobby, and that's fine. But some people are elevating it beyond that, even if they're not getting paid. They should get paid.
Yeah, unfortunately, we're still in the spot, and we've talked about this before, how people have to sort of pay their dues, and that means write for free. Don't write for free.
Don't write for free.
Don't work for free. If they want your stuff, they want your stuff for money.
Yeah. It has value to them.
And negotiate
therefore make them pay for it.
And negotiate it and really elbow them. And if everybody does that, they're not going to take stuff for free.
Yeah.
And they're going to have to start paying people.
Yeah. And they will change the system around a little bit, but the system needs changing. So let it happen. But
because there are so many opinions out there and because they're so varied and because so many people can now gather in groups around common opinions, around films they love or films they hate, the idea of a critic writing a review and undoing a film's success is churlish and foolish to even think of now.
There's no critic who has that much power for more than maybe a small group of people.
You know, who does have the power are fans, groups of fans. Yeah. Look at something like the example I'm going to cite here, and there are plenty to choose from, is Spider-Man 3, the Sam Raimi film. Sam Raimi made Spider-Man 3, hugely expensive movie, gigantic special effects. And it was a hit.
It made a shocking amount of money.
It made a huge amount of money.
It cost too much, so that didn't really make as much of a profit as it should. But that you just for inflation today, I think they made over $1 billion. And it was a hit.
Critics were warm on it, but more importantly, you go on social media and you get this sort of overarching tone of opinion as to what this film is. And it was actually very soon after its release started to feel a little bit reviled in like social media circles.
People got really mad about certain aspects.
Oh, wait a minute. Well, I'm starting to notice this as a fan that they sandwiched in, or they kind of shoehorned in the Venom character.
Yeah, he really doesn't belong in the story, and it's kind of forced.
And I don't think they even named the character in the movie, in that movie. And there's that silly dance scene. And in fact, the scene where Tobey Maguire is possessed by this evil alien intelligence and starts doing dances and is a lot more confident now became so hated among a certain circle of fans that it was even spoofed in the Spider-Man animated film years later. Yeah.
And they're a little, as a sort of a mildly embarrassing moment for Spider-Man.
This was an embarrassing moment for Spider-Man, and they animated that scene again. That's now popular opinion, and that popular opinion outside of what the critics are saying is now holding sway over what's getting held in the consciousness and what's getting sequels and what's being made.
Well, that's kind of behind something I've said for a long time, which is that time is the only critic that matters.
Yeah.
You can be popular in your day, and then, 10 years later, you can be largely reviled or mocked or whatever. And then 20 years later, that whole thing can change.
Mm-hmm.
And I think sometimes the critics are behind that. I think that there's a lot of movies that are in the popular consciousness And they'll always be talked about because people keep talking about them. Mm-hmm. Something like there's been like even like when Joel Schumacher died, I think there was even a bit of a moment where people were reassessing Batman and Robin and saying, okay, maybe it's not, conventionally good, but isn't it interesting? Mm-hmm. And I'd be like, yeah, that's fair.
They put a lot of thought and interesting things into that.
Yeah, it's fair. Yeah, we can have that conversation. That's cool. But I think one of the things that critics can do, and again, I don't even agree with all of the fan waves of every single movie, but I think one of the things that critics can do is remind people of older movies or television or other media that aren't being discussed as often and aren't being discussed whether or not, like, Spider-Man 3 comes up regardless because we're still talking about Spider-Man. But when was the last time you heard someone talk about Chill Factor? You know, it's like, it's only us. This is the only podcast that ever brings that movie up. And we do it mostly as a joke. But it's up to critics, people who actually have take the time and responsibility, take responsibility seriously, to watch older stuff, even if it doesn't seem relevant to what's going on, like, in popular culture today. And reminding people and saying, hey, I just saw this movie. This movie's amazing. This movie is not talked about enough. We should talk about this movie more. That's how we got on a silver platter Citizen Kane, a movie that had big scandal when it came out, won an Academy Award. Critics liked it fine. Took about 10 years for that thing for critics to actually say, no, we really think this one's amazing. And because critics kept talking about it, other people did too. So I think that's one of the biggest responsibilities of a film critic. Is to keep talking about movies that other people aren't necessarily talking about so that they don't go away. And at the very least, people are aware of them and that they know to look at them. And if they come up and the opportunity to watch them arises, they'll do so. And then maybe that movie will come back in some way and its reputation will be redeemed, or it will go from obscure to popular, or vice versa if it turns out it's bad. Anyway, that's my take. So I think the responsibility of film critics is less to shut a movie down and more to find a way to preserve it. If it's good, if it's worthwhile. And every once in a while to speak truth to power and say, like, hey, this movie that's very popular has these flaws. You gotta be honest about it if that's what you see.
I get the feeling though that we're not doing so much of that control anymore as critics. In fact, our job to really,
this will be the last letter,
to kind of fight against the tide of popular opinion, which is the thing that's actually shaping the conversation more than anything.
Right.
And try to cut through all of the hype and all of the thrill of like an opening weekend to talk about the film as it is.
Right. I think from a contemporary perspective, I agree. That's the biggest part of the job in many regards.
And I'm not trying to sort of put critics in sort of this victim position, because that's BS. We're not victims or warriors of any sort.
No.
But we are
I think of a couple, maybe.
Maybe a couple. But we're in this position now where we have to, as critics, be a little bit more stalwart in our opinions and really kind of step forward, because we have so little power over a film's success, and really try to speak out against the powers that be, not just the filmmakers, not just the studios, but also the crashing wave of excitement that comes hand in glove with the advertising machine.
Right. And I think that often paints critics in this light that we are...
That we're all sourpusses.
Yeah, we're all trying to let the air out of the room or whatever. And I would argue that sometimes that's necessary. It's not something you should do just for the hell of it. You should always have a rationale. You should always have a point. You should always have a genuine observation. You shouldn't do it just for its own sake. But if everyone's celebrating something and you say it has a lot of flaws and I disagree with you on this, you need to be able, as a critic, to say that.
And
some people aren't going to like it, but it's the responsibility. You have to be honest about what you saw and be able to explain what you saw so that other people can see it too.
There's a film coming out that's getting great reviews. It's going to be widely loved. It's going to be wildly successful, and I didn't like it. And we'll talk about that when we get to it on Critically Acclaimed.
Looking forward to that. Critically Acclaimed's a little late this week. We thought we'd bang out We've Got Mail. Since we could, I was working out some paperwork and stuff like that. I just couldn't get through all the movies, but we'll be back with that real soon. Mm-hmm. I'll be watching a lot of movies tomorrow. Very excited. Thank you, everybody who run into We've Got Mail. If you want to write in, once again, our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. That's letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Feel free to ask us anything you want about anything you want, and we might answer it on an upcoming We've Got Mail. We're also on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamBibiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
We have a Patreon, patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. We want to give a very special thank you to all of our patrons, without whom this show and all the other shows would not be possible. And if you want to join our Patreon, we have a lot of various tiers. Some of them are, the lowest is $1 a month. And for $1 a month, you get an additional bonus weekly podcast, all dedicated to the 1960s Batman show. We also have other exclusive shows at different tiers, including shows about Disney, the Academy Awards, every single episode of Star Trek, commentary tracks. You get to vote for future episodes of our shows. It's a whole thing. Mm. So thank you very, very much to everybody. You're awesome. Thank you for joining us. And if you can't afford to be part of our Patreon, leave us a review if you can, wherever you find us. Tell people about the show if they're looking for recommendations. That would be really, really great too. And of course, over at Etsy, Salt Cat Soap. A lot of soaps over there.
Buy their soap.
And we're selling them. And coming soon, we're going to have a bunch of new designs. I'm very excited to reveal what M. Lapis de Silva has got for you, because these ones are really cool. Like, the other ones are cool too, but I'm really excited about some of them. I really want to, can't wait to share them with some people. So keep an eye out on the Salt Cat Soap Twitter page, @SaltCatSoap, or @SaltCatSoap on Instagram. And I guess that's about that.
Thanks for writing in. We appreciate having the conversation with you.
Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.